When is it appropriate to stop screening for cancer?
Improving smoking cessation, people discharged from hospitals.
The problem of concussion in middle school girl athletes.
And a new treatment for multi-drug resistant tuberculosis.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 22nd, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
So Rick, how about if we start this week with a study that's gotten quite a bit of media attention? That's the idea, as in a study published in JAMA Internal Medicine, that there's a point in someone's lifetime at which we should probably stop screening them for cancer.
There are clear-cut recommendations on which individuals should be screened and what the timing between the screening should be. One of the recommendations, however, is not to screen individuals that have a short life expectancy. The question this particular study happened to address was, how often does that occur? So they took data from the population-based National Health Interview Study. This was data that was available over a 10-year period. It included over 27,000 individuals that were over the age of 65. And then they used a validated mortality index to group these individuals into those that had a low or high mortality risk or somewhere in between over the next 9 years. And what they discovered is that in these individuals with a very high mortality, greater than 75% chance they're going to die in the next 9 years, that 31 to 55% of them still received cancer screening. Screening for things like prostate cancer, about 55% of individuals. Screening for cervical cancer, about 25%. And colorectal cancer, about 40%.
Of course, the follow-up to that is if they got unnecessarily screened, did they also get unnecessarily treated?
And sometimes that's the case. And the question is, well, how do we effectively educate both physicians and patients? The second thing is perhaps we need to regulate whether these physicians who do these tests or the hospitals that recommend it get paid or not. If you're doing unnecessary screening that doesn't provide a net benefit and a potential harm to the patient, then they shouldn't be reimbursed.
I guess the other thing this calls into, at least my awareness, is the idea that physicians are increasingly called upon to spend a lot of time educating people. So this model of shared decision making, specifically with regard to cancer screening, does require a lot of time in order to explain to a patient, hey, you know what, it's just not appropriate for you at this point.
It does. And Elizabeth, it seems like every week we talk about more and more we're putting on the backs of the physicians that we expect them to do, immunizations and screening and unnecessary screening and nutrition. So many different things need to be done. And that's why I said this isn't just a physician's role. The patients need to own this as well. When their physician recommends screening, they have to say, well, will this provide a benefit and is this indicated in my particular case?
Moving target, of course, just like screening, and no doubt we'll be talking about it a lot more as time goes on. Let's move from here to something that physicians are also being called upon to help with. That's an opportunity. This is based on a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association for really intervening effectively in helping people to stop smoking.
When a patient is hospitalized, it gives the patient new motivation to attack chronic diseases or illnesses, and it also gives the physician a new opportunity to address chronic diseases, one of those being cigarette smoking. And this particular study said, can we be more effective in helping people stop smoking that have been in the hospital and expressed a desire to do so? So this was a randomized clinical trial that compared standard care, physician talked to the patient and recommended routine therapies to the patient. The other half received what was called sustained care. There was a post-discharge tobacco cessation intervention that consisted of automated telephone calls and also the offering of free medical therapy and stopping smoking. Over the course of 6 months after the patient was discharged, they received regularly scheduled phone calls, 2 days and 14 days, and 30 days and 60 days and 90 days. They were actually made by a computer. They prompted the smokers to continue their smoking cessation. They offered medication refills, and they also offered the opportunity for the patient to be contacted by a healthcare provider. And what they discovered was for those that received the standard care, only about 15% were successful in smoking cessation. And by the way, they confirmed that by testing for nicotine levels. For those that received the sustained care, 26%, about a 70% increased likelihood that there was smoking cessation.
Outstanding. Any efforts, of course, that help people to successfully stop smoking, I think, need to be applauded and supported. It probably wasn't very costly either, even with the provision of the medications to help.
No. And in fact, both groups were offered medications. Again, I want to stress that this was done in patients that already expressed a desire to quit and just giving them the tools they need to be successful.
Let's turn from here then, since we're going to stay in this JAMA family. Let's go to JAMA Pediatrics. Lots and lots of discussion, of course, among professional football players and other athletes about the problem of concussion and brain injury and subsequent development of dementia. Let's go way, way earlier, and let's look at middle school girls.
There's not a lot of data in this particular age group, and we know that females are more likely to get concussions than males with the same amount of head trauma. And secondly, children and adolescents are at increased risk compared to older individuals. This was a prospective study that was conducted over a course of 4 years among four soccer clubs in the Puget Sound region of Washington State. It involved 351 elite female soccer players aged 11 to 14 years. It looked at the cumulative incidence of concussions during this time period, the number, the type, and the duration of symptoms. There were 59 concussions, 13% per season. And the symptoms lasted a median of 4 days. Individuals expressed either some sensitivity to light, emotional lability, some that had noise sensitivity, memory loss, or nausea or concentration problems. And in those particular individuals, the symptoms could last for 7 to 15 days. A lot of these were due to heading. Balls kicked in the air and the person hits it with their head, and about almost a third of the concussions were related to that particular activity. The disconcerting thing was that most players continued to play even after they had symptoms, almost 60%. And very few of those individuals, about 44% of the individuals, actually sought medical attention.
Wow. So more distressing news as far as I'm concerned about the potential downside of participation in group sports and how it can impact on your health over the long term in a not very positive way. What's the solution for this problem?
Education plays a major role. Parents, but also educating the coaches in the youth sports leagues. Most of the coaches in the youth sports leagues really don't know anything about this. So I think we need to have a grassroots level effort.
All right. So I think that that's a really fine strategy, but I would also suggest that in lots of sports, the promulgation of helmet use has always appealed to me. We've seen that that's happening more often, even in things like downhill skiing. And I really hope that as the risks of concussion, especially when it's repeated and it happens early in life, are exposed, that more people will adopt this practice.
The issue in soccer is a little bit different. Part of the sport is actually heading the ball, and does the use of a helmet actually increase the rate of head trauma? Because as you know, when people put helmets on, they're more likely to use their head in sporting events. Would it be effective in this particular sport? It'll be interesting to see over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years whether headgear becomes a prominent part in soccer.
And the last word that I'm going to say on this is that clearly soccer, just as every other organized sport has, is in a process of evolution. And perhaps what we ought to do is just say, we're not going to be hitting the ball anymore, folks. We're going to develop something else. Maybe that's elbows. Let's turn to our last study then. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine. A look at multi-drug resistant TB and a potential for effective intervention.
Now, according to the World Health Organization, the global burden of tuberculosis is large. There was an estimated 8.6 million new cases in 2012, and there were reported almost 500,000 drug-resistant tuberculosis cases. The mortality with tuberculosis, if untreated, is pretty high. That is, at the end of 10 years, about 70% of individuals with TB that aren't treated die. We've not had a new drug for tuberculosis in the last 40 years, or I should say a new class of drugs, until the FDA approved a drug in 2012 called bedaquiline. This study is one of those studies that encouraged the FDA to use this particular drug. They identified 160 patients with newly diagnosed multi-drug resistant TB. They were treated with the standard care, which involves five different medications, or the use of five medications plus bedaquiline for 24 weeks. What they determined was that the patients who received the five drugs, it took them 125 days for those which it cleared. For those that received the five drugs plus bedaquiline, it was 83 days. The cure rate was 32% in their standard therapy and 58% in those that received standard therapy plus bedaquiline. Now, the downside was there were more deaths in the bedaquiline group. Only one died of therapy with the drug, and the next study will involve a longer period of time with more patients looking not at the surrogate endpoints, but really does it improve survival over the long term?
I'm not really sure that I'm going to sing the praises of this particular drug, although I will sing the praises of a strategy to develop new drugs, and specifically with regard to MDR-TB and XDR-TB, because these are really big threats, and I'm not sure we really appreciate how big a threat they are.
And while it may not be this particular medication, it may be a medication in this group.
On that note, I'm going to reveal that in the blog this week, I'm going to talk about concussions among middle school girls. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.